Welcome to Mother Puckers, the first and only podcast for hockey moms by a hockey mom, and that's me, Julie Bardowski, alongside the 13th disciple, Lou Mangialuzzo. Hi, Lou.
How are we doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, the weather's nice today, and it's going to be nice for a few more days. Got the Atlantic District tryouts coming up here this weekend in New Jersey. So I might pop in on that.
I'm going to be doing that same thing in Nashville for the Southeast District.
Yeah, and I see that I think Mid-Am did theirs last weekend.
And California.
So everybody's popping around. Hockey never stops.
It never stops. And that's okay. I mean, everybody's got to stay occupied and active. I mean, we don't want to just turn into beer drinking fools and, you know, fast food eating fools in the summertime, right?
Yep. So we'll just have to, I think hockey's pretty much, I don't think we're a 12 month, but we're like an 11th month sport now.
So is soccer and football and basketball.
Really?
Oh yeah. They do spring things and summer camps and it's all the same in youth sports. Everybody's doing it.
Someone found a way to turn it into that, to make some money. Cause you know, money makes the world go round, right?
Well, I don't know if money's going to make the NHL Stanley Cup Conference Finals and Stanley Cup Finals go around, since it's in medium non-traditional hockey markets between Vegas, Dallas, Carolina, and Florida.
Yeah, in that regard, maybe, but they'll still sell advertising. They got their own deal, TV deal's done. It's not like they can go back on it. I'm sure they have some caveats for incentives, for ratings, and how many people are watching, or maybe the price goes up, but I don't think those people really care about anybody else anyway. They're in the Stanley Cup Finals. There's only four teams left, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's good, though, because from a youth hockey perspective, it's really great because there's going to be a lot of kids that are going to get inspired that have never even heard of hockey if you're living in Miami, and they're going to see that their team, the Florida Panthers, are in this, you know, fight for the conference championship, and maybe we're going to get some great new hockey players coming out of this.
Yeah, we might. I'll be an old man by then, but probably. But I'll tell you, I was just thinking about something about the fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's like the fan that's going to go to the rally, watch it on the big screen. They'll cheer, they'll clap, they'll hoot, they'll holler. But you know what? The fan that actually, and we've all done this, the fan that's actually in it so much, you know that person, right?
Yep.
If they're like sitting on the edge of the couch and they're actually praying, right? Their teeth is clenched. They're playing every pass, right? You know that person, right?
Yep.
They're playing every shot. Like the nerves, they're almost, you see these fans, like, I think this is the great part about it. The casual guy that's having a beer, oh, they won, they lost, that's great, we have another beer. That's a different guy. That's a different animal, right?
Well, this time, you got the event goers. That's the other, you've got the casual fan, the event goers who want to say that they've been there, and then you've got the fanatic.
You know, we need them too.
Oh, yeah.
It's that one that's on the couch playing, right? That they've got their hands so clenched so hard they cramp when they let go.
Heck yeah.
Or when it's over, when they lose, they cry. That's a different animal, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. That is really cool.
It's very cool. Well, I know how I am with like watching my kid play. If I go 2 weeks, I'm kind of jonesing to see him play. 3 weeks is really pushing it. I can't go more than a month without watching him play. I go back and watch like videos I've got on my phone and stuff. Cause I mean, I just love watching him play. You know what I mean? So I get that fanatic level of fandom for sure.
That's a good word for it. Yeah. That's a good word for it. And when you're, whether it's basketball or other sports,
yeah,
or this fan, like in Edmonton the other night, after they lost. Like,
yeah.
They're just sitting there. They're just like, they're like numb.
Yep. I've known that feeling many times because the only team that I cheer for that has, well, now the Blues have, but before the Blues won that Stanley Cup, the only team that I've cheered for in my life won a championship were the St. Louis Cardinals. So most of my life has been spent being that fan, being numb in the stands. After
the loss. Yeah, listen, Philadelphia's had a lot of those moments too. The Phillies didn't win for like 100 years, right? And I think they won in 1980, and then they won after that. Last year they had a good team, they lost, right? But that, like, the Flyers haven't won the Stanley Cup for 50 years. And I feel good they're going to get it turned around. They got a great fan base there. They'll figure it out. Like the football won, they hadn't won. The Eagles hadn't won since 1960. So Philadelphia's had their share of – but you know the great thing about Philadelphia and living here is that here's what people don't understand about people from Philadelphia.
Oh, no.
We know nobody likes us. And we actually – we don't give a shit.
It's fine. It's fair. It's totally fair.
Some of us might even enjoy being hated.
Well, you know, the thing that's going on, well, just outside of Pennsylvania right now, is the USHL finals between Fargo Force and the Youngstown Phantoms. They're Phantoms went up 2-0 in the series in Fargo, and now it's headed to Youngstown. That's just right next to Pennsylvania. Like, isn't it right on the border? I've been there.
Yes, and to that point, you know what Youngstown's famous for?
I do not.
Well, that was pit stop for the mafia. You know what I mean? You know, because that was the halfway point to Chicago.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that town was booming in the 30s, man.
So it was built on blood, sweat, and waste management money.
I can only imagine what, if you've been to Youngstown, obviously.
Yep, went to the arena. It's really nice.
I can only imagine what I know what it's like now. I can only imagine what it was like in the 40s and 50s.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll bet you it was a rock'em sock'em nightclub going, infested with nightlife. And I'll bet you the coal mine was, there was money there because the coal industry was big. The steel industry was big because Pittsburgh's close by, right?
Yeah.
I'll bet you there was tons of money there, and nightlife and everything. Unlike what it kind of is now, right? You know what I mean?
It's a little bit sleepier.
It's a lot sleepier, yeah.
And they've got the fireworks company there. That's the Phantom Fireworks.
That's Murray Gunthy's team, right? Murray Gunthy owns the Phantoms, right?
Yep.
So that's the Phantoms against our friend Kerry Needs that was on our show.
Yep.
A couple weeks back.
They got to pull out 3 wins in a row in order to win the Clark Cup.
You mean now the series now you're talking about?
Yeah, it's best of 5.
They're down 2-0.
They're down 2-0 at home. They lost. Yeah.
They're in some trouble, right?
That's hard. It's hard to do. Not impossible.
No, I wonder, is this the first chance? Is this, if the Youngstown wins, is it the first time they've ever won it, do you know, by chance?
Oh, I don't think so. Hold on.
I don't really know, to be honest with you. I'm not really sure if they've ever won it before. You know what? That's an interesting question.
I'm looking it up right now. Oh, it would be their first Clark Cup win.
Well, you're quick. How'd you get that so quick?
Because I'm fast. I rifle through my brain. It was all my brain. There was no Google involved.
Artificial intelligence. Yes.
So that's going on. Hey, you mentioned that you're watching the Atlantic districts for national camp. So for our listeners, I've talked about the past couple of years. When you get to 14, you can go to the Futures Development Camp. 15, you go straight. You could go to the national camp. You try out in your local area. Then you go to your affiliate. And then you go with the whole district to try to get out, go to national camp. Where when you're 16, you can play for Team USA in the Five Nations Cup. And when you're 17, you can play for Team USA in the Hlinka Gretzky Cup. And that's going on right now. And there's a big change, it seems, underfoot. And Lou, you have some knowledge about this. It looks like from the lists that have come out of California, Minnesota, and the Central District so far, those are completed. And congratulations to those boys who've made it through.
And girls.
Well, the girls aren't done yet. They're not. Okay. They haven't done theirs yet. But yes, we will talk about that. But it seems that they're going to do the district versus district instead of just mashing up all the boys across, 10 teams versus each other. Now they're doing district versus district, and it looks like 9 forwards, 5 D, and 1 goalie's coming out, whereas in years past, for example, in the Southeast District, only 6 forwards, 3 D, and a potential goalie would come out of the Southeast District, whereas, you know, you'd get 17 forwards out of Minnesota and so on. But so to what you and Lou Vero were talking about, the best versus the best in their district, you know, seems like it might be happening. I haven't gotten confirmation from anybody at USA Hockey, and I've reached out, but as soon as I do, that would be that. But it seems to be that's what they're going to do. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, when I was involved in it, it was the way you're talking that it could go back to.
Okay.
I guess maybe in hindsight, or looking back, when it was that way, maybe you had the, well, I think they have a district called the Northern Plains District now. I don't know if that was ever a district before. There was the Pacific District, and the Rocky Mountain always had a district. And they may have been some of the weaker sisters, like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And therefore, some at-large kids would end up on their teams. But it was still district by district, but there was some supplementation with some of those weaker divisions, right, or weaker districts. And then somehow, some way, they went to, like, a picking of players or a drafting of players somehow. Maybe when they all showed up on the first day of camp, they divided the kids up and they picked teams. How they did that, I wasn't familiar with it. But I can say that looking back on it, I think when they left it, the kids in the Atlantic District, John DeNorcia runs that, right? You know, under Glenn Heffron. Mm-hmm. I think our kids like that better. Our kids wanted to know, now we're like Delaware, Eastern PA. I think it's in Wilkesboro as well, I think. I mean, the district are they playing? They're not playing in New York. So it's probably Eastern Pennsylvania, which is probably considered Wilkesboro as well, right? And then New Jersey.
Yeah, there's an Eastern Western Pennsylvania. Yeah,
right. That's mid-air, right? Okay. Yeah. Right. So those kids all knew each other, and I think they like going to the USA Natty camp and proving themselves against Massachusetts. So yeah. I like that. Why they left it, I think we talked about maybe that's a possibility why they left it. We touched on that. But I'm really not sure. I just got some confirmation. My friend, who you know, the Shakiris, right?
Oh, yep.
Mm-hmm. Jaden made the Mid-Am camp, so he's going to go to Natty camp. So they must have come out with a list.
Nice. And, here it is. It just came out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's yeah.
Great stuff for him.
I see it.
But
they've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They have 8 forwards, 4 D, and 1 goaltender coming out.
Okay.
So it's not hitting the 9-5-1. So maybe they're going to mix up one of the districts. I don't know.
I think it was okay I think it's okay to add a couple districts if they need a couple players to help them compete. I'm sure people from that district don't love the idea, but it's about the greater good and about the whole process. I like it. I don't know whose idea it was to go back for that. For all that would have been, it could have been Bob Mancini's. You know, I'm not sure. He's the exec, you know, he's going back there now working there. So he has a lot of experience. And his son plays at UNO, good player, defenseman, drafted by the Rangers. But like I said, I like it. I do like it. I like the pride thing that this is our team. You know, they're going to knock the socks off type thing.
Right? Well, and you think about it, most of these kids of in those districts before they're all scooting off to play outside of their district when they're 14, 15, 16 years old, they grew up playing with each other, so they know each other, and it might make for better hockey, you know, during the Natty camp. But I think we still have some questions to be answered, but real time here, everybody that we've seen so far had 9-5-1, except for Mid-Am, which has 8-4-1.
Yeah,
so
they might be leaving something. Some space for some kids that...
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, maybe there'll be a kid that's they ask the Atlantic District, what do you got? Oh, we got it. It's a tough call here on a couple kids. And
yeah.
You know, we have a kid that really deserves to be there. We don't have room for him. I'm sure Massachusetts will have a couple kids like that for sure. Listen, life's competitive in everything we do. There's no more, you know what? There's no free lunches. There's not supposed to be. okay?
There and, shouldn't be. Well, no, they're trying to give free lunches out, and we don't want that.
Do that. There's a lot of that.
We don't want that.
When you're giving free lunches out, it doesn't mean as much, right?
Agree.
And speaking of free lunches,
yep,
I had a parent sign up their child with the 09 group, and he was the 2010 for Liberty Bowl games. And someone tipped me off on it. So I just, you know, obviously not going to mention the person, but I called the guy and said, like, your kid's a 2010. Now, with the younger kids, we can miss it because it's their first year of eligibility. You follow me?
Yeah.
So we don't know those kids like we know the kids a year older or 2 or 3 years older, right? So,
right.
You know, and when I said to him, like, you know, the menu drop down doesn't go to 2010. So how could you make that mistake? And I said, it only goes to 2009. And he said to me, well, he's a big kid. You know what my response was when he said that? I don't give a shit if he's a Jolly Green Giant. Okay? This is not the way it's run. These aren't the rules, and you should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, I can't.
I came within an inch of saying to him, you're banned forever.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I just don't understand it. I've run across that within very close relations, trying to push their kid up, and
but I mean, they'll do anything. Like it's not even about pushing the kid up. It could be anything with them. They'll do anything. Some of these people, like
oh yeah, that's a whole episode there, Lou. Because boy, we could tell all kinds of hockey parent stories, but we're not going to do that on this episode.
The person that tipped me off a little bit felt bad, and I said, no. Don't feel bad because you're protecting what we have. Like the integrity of what we do needs to stay enforced.
It does.
Right? So don't feel like you ratted him out. Like you did. I would expect any parent to do that and say, Lou, you know, he got a little, because you're protecting what we have, right? What we've created. So for me, that's the greater good. Like I want to know if somebody's playing around or doing something wrong.
Yeah. Right? Well, and I mean, I'm just going to say this and then we're going to stop because then I'll keep going. But parents, do not think if you don't say something, or wait, how do I need to say this? Please say something if something is wrong with how your kid is being treated, whether it's bullying, whether it's this or that. If you're not saying something because you're afraid your kid's not going to have enough ice time or get pushed down the bench on the lineup, that is a wrong value system. If you see something, you got to say something, man.
Values come in a, they're not in the pre, it's, I don't even know. It's not like it once was, but.
No.
But like I said, I don't think he liked it. Like I said.
Sure not. I mean, obviously he wanted his kid playing because he responded I didn't know that. Yeah.
He said, my kid plays against 08s.
Oh, yeah.
But he's not an 09. Like, I'm sorry. Like which word is it, selective amnesia? Like, which word don't you understand?
Yeah.
It's not that there's rules.
There's a reason for the rules, so follow them.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know what, Lou? There's rules to help people who have questionable values.
Evidently, that's what it was designed for.
Yes. Yep. Okay, we're moving on. So the draft for major juniors in the U.S. and Canada are complete. I think there was something like, I don't know, over 350 kids drafted in the USHL. And I followed it closely. I saw about 10% of that draft went to Russia.
I know. Maybe you mentioned that before. I saw a lot of Canadians were drafted as well.
I know. What's going on? Isn't this the USHL?
I don't know. I think the Putin's going to come down with a sickle.
I think Putin is going to find the names of those kids on that draft list, and there's already KGB at those parents' doors saying your kid not leaving Russia.
Yeah. And by the way, congratulations to your son.
Thank you. Very exciting. Very excited for him. That'll be a fun experience to share when he goes to camp.
Yeah.
But what was the other thing that I wanted to share along those lines? You brought up Ryan Whitney. You had some interaction with him, and you got – no. Craig Button. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah. So Craig Button, who Father Jack Button, ran Central Scouting for decades, was in Washington. Craig was GM in Calgary, I think, and he was in Dallas and stuff. And I saw him on Twitter about a month ago. I haven't seen him for a year or so, maybe more. And last time I saw him, I was with his dad played for the Nordiques. He went to Northern Michigan. Oh, San Jose. He's in Ottawa.
I have no idea.
Oh my God!
Usually, I can get there with you, but I'm lost on this one.
Anyway, that's the last time I saw him at Plymouth. He said something on Twitter about rules. Basically, he had a rule.
Let's tell everybody. It's in relation to the hit that Truba put on.
Well, it's not in relation to that.
Oh, okay.
It's in relation to when there's a big hit, right? And when there's a big hit that's legal, a lot of times there's there's retaliation, right? So like even if it's a legal hit. there's a retaliation, right? And what he's saying is that what should happen is basically, long and short of it, what should happen is if a player hits a player legally, and that player or a teammate of that player, Josh Norris, his dad. Dwayne Norris played at Northern. He was in Nordique when I was with the Nordiques.
All right.
And the long and short, that's the last time I saw Craig. He was at Plymouth. So a player gets hit with a legal check. The player that got hit, a teammate of his comes and goes after the player that made the hit, a clean hit. And usually he gets a 2-minute instigator. That's the price you pay for starting the fight, right? But both players get 5 minutes fighting, right?
Mm-hmm.
What Craig is saying is that shouldn't be the case, okay? He's saying that the player that instigates it should get 2, and they should get 5. And the player that is being – the guy who went after him, the player that is on the receiving end of the instigation, shouldn't get anything because he's just defending himself.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
And which does make a lot of sense. He didn't choose to fight. Someone attacked him. Now, if it's a illegal hit, that person that made the illegal hit is obviously going to get a penalty, whether it's 2 minutes or 5 minutes anyway. And then there might be a 2 minutes aggressive on the other guy. But long and short of it, excuse me, I'm so sorry. But long and short of it, he thinks the player that's doing the instigation and the action against the player that made the hit should get 7 minutes. And the other player shouldn't get anything because all he's doing is defending himself. And it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That would give guys a thought once in a while. Because every time you see a big hit now, whether it's legal or not,
right?
There's always an action. There's always a reaction to the action, right?
Sure. Yep.
And I kind of like what he's saying. Like, if you want to put your team down 7 minutes now,
right?
That's in essence what you'd be doing.
Right.
That might stop some of that extracurricular activity.
They'd have to make up their own rule, though, on those 5 minutes, because it can't be a 5-minute major traditionally, or you're going to have 5 minutes of scoring going on, or, unfettered scoring capability option.
Well, yeah, they can fix how they want to design it.
Yeah.
But to your point is, then don't do the
then don't do it.
Yeah. Action.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to play with fire, you're going to get burned.
Well, and you know what? To the whole speeding up of the game kind of a thing, by stopping those types of retaliations and those types of headhunting, that could answer some of the league's problems for keeping things moving faster.
Yeah, including the tag up rule.
Oh, my gosh. Didn't you say you spoke to somebody maybe that might be happening?
Jim Doyle, who's a referee chief here in the area, and said that there's usually a period of time when they make a rule that they can't go back on it for a period of time, whether it's 3 years or whatever. But I think they're going back to tag up next
Gosh,
year.
I hope so. That was the dumbest change.
Really, it was not a smart idea.
Yeah, because usually the rules that they change are 4 years in the time, so this would only be 2 years since that.
Yeah, they're going to change it. They realized, evidently, the elder statesmen realized, oh, this wasn't a great idea, whoever makes these decisions. But it does slow the game down quite a bit. Well, I know at our event, we play our own rules. We've been playing our own rules at Liberty Bell games since it started. We don't do that. We've been playing tag up even when we got all kinds of different rules, and I think we have an automatic icing. I think we have a couple of different rules that haven't been normal USA Hockey rules, only because I just didn't think they were good for what we were doing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So that's it on that. You know. So.
That's good. Well, I hope that happens because I did not like that rule change at all. Most of the time when USA Hockey does their rule changes, they're really, they're good. I mean, you know, they're good. So these two that they made, that one and the icing, those were bonehead calls. So we'll have to get somebody on. Maybe we'll get Jim Doyle on and he can confirm what's going on.
Yeah. They're good. I mean, they train their referees. During our event, they have a supervisor. They come in, four men, four women. You know, they have a seminar and they get their swag. And you know, so we're on speaking on that note. We're 3 weeks. We're the girls are second, third, and fourth, and the boys are 9, 10, 11. And then the Florida boys are the weekend after that. We'll see how that goes. The Panthers are going to be, if they win this round, they'll be getting off the ice on the 15th or 14th for practice to fly to Vegas or Dallas, and we'll be going on the ice.
That's cool.
So they'll be out of there just when the, I'm sure it's exciting down there. I'm sure that they've been sold out, I think. So that's great for them. Mr. Viola and his wife, they certainly have been ruined. Pardon me?
Sorry. I'll cut that out. The Violas, go with the Violas.
Yeah, they, you know, Vinny and his wife have been real troopers for Gary Bettman in the National Hockey League. They've stuck with it through some really tough times.
Yeah. Empty not facilities.
So some nights they had 7,000-8,000 there, and they really hung in there. He's lost quite a bit of money, I would think, over time. Former West Point graduate. And,
wow.
You know, at Virtue Capital, wonderful people, big family. He's got three boys, grandkids now. They stuck with it, you know, and kudos to them. They didn't have to. They could have just walked away from it and said, you know, Gary, this is a losing venture. We're not interested. Boom, boom, boom. Or could have really banged a hammer to move the franchise. Good for them.
If they make it to the finals, I can't wait to watch youth hockey explode in South Florida over the next few years, because it'll happen.
Yeah, it really could use it. I know Tampa, it's a little bigger up north than it is in South Florida, but because Tampa's been good for so long.
Yeah.
They're moving. They've also did, you know what else they did down there was they, I think in downtown Fort Lauderdale, Vinny and his group there and his family, they bought a armory, and I think it might be ready now. I'm not sure. They're putting two sheets of ice going in where that's where the Panthers are going to practice from now on, downtown Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what it's called.
You know, I did hear that. I did hear they're moving the practice up to Fort Lauderdale because most of the players live up that way.
Yeah, so they're going to put the armory.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's, I don't know what, it was an old building. It was probably decrepit and shut down, and you know they excuse me, it's called let's see, 356 Florida National Guard. I don't know if that's the building they took over, but they are, I think it's done now, or it was scheduled to be done. It says here the FTL Fort Lauderdale War Memorial Home 2023 renewed community hub in Fort Lauderdale's largest city for Community Florida Panthers, $65 million, standing tribute for military heroes. And, you know, his Vinny is a West Point guy, you follow me?
Yep.
He's big on that, actually. You know, he has every, when they got the shoulder patch, the military patch, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I love when they repurpose buildings that are already built. I know sometimes it might become more expensive bringing things up to code, but like, you know, what's happening in Vegas for the Oakland A's to move over there, raising a new stadium. Now, granted, they have to because they don't have one there. But, you know, cities who have facilities and then spend hundreds of billions of dollars to build a new one, taxpayer, private, wherever the money's coming from, it just kills me because that money could go in so many other places and do so much good.
Well, I'm looking at it here. It's a standing tribute, 93 acre, 1950 it was opened.
Nice.
It looks like it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah. See, if they can repurpose a 1950s building and bring it up to code, then that should be an example for how everybody else should be looking at these facilities.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, our, like, that's the thing. Our event is down there in the summer, and we're going through something like, speaking of that right now, is that, well, you'll know this because you're in it. Like, I don't know why I'm bringing this up. I just watched looking at this new building they're building, and I have a good relationship with the Violas, is that, you know, when they had the 0405 group down there, that was a pretty good group. And that, you know, how this goes, and it has webs and flows to it. Some birth dates are better than others, right? And
yeah,
the 0607 hasn't been as good. And there's one other event in Florida. It's in April and then in June. And we haven't been affected by them. But, you know, the Florida people are just a little different, okay? And, you know, like, we don't need to beg players to come. And we're full. But what we've noticed over the last 2 years is, let's say you have 30 good players that are between the ages 06, 07, 08. Let's say you have 30. And then you have a bunch of double-A kids or some triple-A kids, but they're not as good as the other 30. Sometimes the better kids don't want to play against the average kids, fair?
No, they don't. They don't.
And this is the thing that I have to talk to them about, is that when we went to Florida, we tried to go down there with an idea of bringing them something for themselves, right? So you don't have to fly to Chicago or Detroit, that you just need to get in the car and drive 30 minutes or an hour to the rink. We'll bring people in to watch. And as we noticed over the last 2 years, Austin, you know, Austin, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
What we found out is...
Episode 47.
Yeah, what we found out is that we're finding out is the best players just don't want to play against the average kids. And for us to hunt these kids down, to send emails, to badger mom and dad, and some of the best kids don't want to come, we're looking at the big picture saying, is this really what we want? We don't want an average event. Right. And,
right.
You know, we want a high end event like we have in New Jersey. You follow me? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, can it continue? And the end result might be that, you know what? We've recognized the fact that the best players will go anywhere to play.
Mm-hmm.
Fair.
Yep.
So in the end, as much as we tried or have tried to do this locally, keep it cost effective, you don't need a hotel for the most part. In the end, it might not fly. It might just be, you know what? Well, we tried. You know what? And we did all we could as Samaritans and custodians. But you know what? You 30 kids from Florida, you 30 kids from Nashville and Carolina, you know what? You're just going to have to come to New Jersey.
Well, you know, I agree with you, and I love that you're staying local and being a great custodian for the game. What I wish for, because here's where I see, you know, kids leave sports age 14, 15 years old. They leave sports because, in my opinion, there's too much pressure to get a college scholarship or to go pro in the sports that have pros or to go to the Olympics or whatever it may be, instead of just developing, growing, and building something that you can play and do for the rest of your life. So maybe you guys could think about having two divisions. It might be difficult. And of course, you know, some of the kids may want to say, well, I want to play up, or, you know, whatever that might be. And that's a big rat's nest. But have a division where kids can just come and play, or where they're not worried about scouts coming and seeing them, where they're just having an opportunity to get out there and have fun.
Yeah, and maybe we still do that. That may be the case. But listen, here's the thing on that. That's easier said.
It is. I know.
Here's what happens. If you do that, let's say in Florida next year, and you have 100 double A kids, let's say that's what it is, kids that just want to play hockey.
And it could be single A. Yeah.
Whatever it is, here's the problem with it. You're going to get mom and dad.
I know.
Kids, a single A player, right? Or a double A player, right?
I know.
It's going to say, where are the scouts?
I know.
Well, they're not coming to this. Well, why not? Well, because the kids aren't good enough. What do you mean my kids aren't good enough? Like, believe me, I'm really struggling with this because I'm good friends with Vince, Vinny, and Teresa. And you know, but the fact of it is, I'll give an example. I'm worried. Think about this. I'm worried about Mr. and Mrs. Johnson in Boga having something for their kid to come to locally for $500 friggin'. And meanwhile, I just went to World Youth, which, by the way, nobody was even at. I saw Penn State, two agents, Lincoln. Okay, that all being said, a whole team came from Florida. Think about this. A whole team came up there in New Jersey for 4 days. That's four nights in a hotel. Minimal. Might have been five. They played on a team. They flew up here. Okay. In the end, they had to eat. And in the end, it cost them about $2,500. You follow me? If they're not worried about it, why should we be worried about it?
Right.
Does that make sense? Yep. Like, I'm beating my head against the wall to help these people. And they don't care about it. So why am I beating my head against the wall? We're in New Jersey, 216 06 to 07s, 08s, another 30 or 40 kids, 09s, boys and girls, 350 Division I, 35 drafted the NHL, 9 in the National Hockey League, all from within 125 miles of my home.
Yeah.
I went out of Florida, beat my head against the wall with Austin to try to get these people to come.
Yeah.
And the 30 best kids, only 10 come. And they'd rather fly to New Jersey, spend $2,500, you follow me?
Yeah.
To play against the best kids.
Yeah.
And in the end, that's what might happen.
It might. I just want to keep kids playing hockey.
I do too.
I want to keep parents being realistic. Let's just have fun.
So
yeah.
I'll give you an example before we change the subject. A guy that played for us in Binghamton, Tony Avisi, he went to Cornell. He's got a thing, Matterhorn, in the Gulf Coast. It's last week of April. He's a little bit different animal in April than he's got in June. He's a week, he's 4 days from me. He's almost on the same date in June when I go down to Florida. So some of the best kids in Florida or on the Gulf Coast. You probably know that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're down there with Brimley, who went to Miami or played hockey. It was Thunder Bay kid. His kid Gavin goes to Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So as much as those kids came to me every year, they realized this year, God, I live on the Gulf Coast. If I go to Fort Lauderdale, I got to drive over there.
Right.
I got to stay at the place for 3 nights. Mm-hmm. I got to get a hotel. So, yeah, Lou Mangialuzzo is charging me $525. And the guy in the Gulf Coast is charging me $1,000. But in the end, it's the same because I got to spend the money to go over there anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened was this year, he was still looking for some players, obviously, last month. I got the call about it. But, like, that kid that's lives in Fort Myers area, it's the same price now. So he's saying, why don't I just stay home?
Yeah.
And if that's going to be the case, you know what? Next year, you know what, boys? Here's the deal. You want to come up to Jersey with a better quality product because the hockey's better in general, quality-wise? 16 teams, come on up. And I met some Carolina kids at World Youth. And the kids said to me, yeah, we came to it the first year, but it wasn't as good the second year and winning. We know that. But you, as much as you try to create and help them, if they're not going to reciprocate and all come, and even if they all did come, Julie, there's not enough quality.
Well, I don't think it's just there. I mean, I think every camp has its high, low, medium, you know, players within it. Every camp, you know, we've ever gone to, there's definite differences. I think, you know, I think these camps are great because it gives kids exposure to each other. I'm not talking about exposure to anything other than within their little camp. You know, kids who, you know, they'll learn things from each other, whether they're a higher level player or lower level player. You know, there is not a camp out there or a weekend out there where you're going to have equanimity across skill set, except most likely the only one would be Natty Camp that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, right.
That would be where you'd have the best parity.
Right. Right. No, I completely get it.
And it's okay. It's okay. These camps should be for fun, where you get to go out, you get to explore, you get to have time and space and creative and do different things, and you're not worried about winning and losing and, you know, what your record is in my hockey rankings for the standings, you know. I think these camps are important no matter the skill level so that kids can just go out and play hockey.
Yeah, and we're all for that too, and that's, we don't have a problem with that.
Yeah,
but I would just say this, and there's plenty of those. I would just say this.
Well, I think they all should be.
And that's fine. When we designed this, here's what I tell the parents: you need to come to this, and here's why you need to come to it. You need to come to it because the kids have a blast.
Yeah.
Because the competition's good.
Yep.
People come to watch. If you don't come to it, here's what's going to happen. Lou Mangialuzzo is going to go away, okay? Someone will no-doubtedly fill my void, okay? And then they'll charge the living shit out of you. So that's your choice. Go to something that's going to cost twice as much, or come to us, and maybe we'll be talking about this 15, 20 years later. Yeah. But if you don't, then what you do is, we won't be around in 2, 3, 4 years. And someone will fill the void, and they'll charge the living shit out of you and prostitute your kid. And then you'll be going, oh, what happened to Lou? Well, he didn't come to the event.
Well, and you're not the only one. Everybody has this problem. Every camp that's out there, they lose kids, whether they get an injury or whether they get something else going on. I mean,
yeah, I know that.
Yeah, it's just kind of it's a summer thing too. I mean, it's summertime. Kids, you know, vacations, you know, all that kind of stuff goes on. I think to make it the most attractive you can, like you're doing, is great. It's a great way to go. So our guest today talks about, if we're talking way back about some things that we've talked about, history making, 1972 Super Series between Canada and Russia. Sean Mitten wrote some books about it, and then he built and developed a mind mapping tool to help not just athletes, but, you know, work people who work, corporate people, all that stuff to go through. And I talk more about that with him, we talk more about that in the intro about him. But it's kind of interesting when we look at, you know, all the competition out there, country versus country, district versus district, conference versus conference. To then bring back this 72 series, because that's going way back. And how, you know, everybody remembers where they are at certain points in their life. The 80 Olympic win for the U.S., apparently the 72 series, which I don't know anything about other than what we talked about in the episode. But it's pretty cool to have these conversations with people learning new things about it.
Yeah, the one famous thing with Phil Esposito pleading to the Canadian public, like, this is hard.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, let's kick into our interview, Lou, and then we'll catch up again next week.
Okay.
We're now actually talking to a full-on Canadian. However, he lives in North Carolina. So There you have it. But he's an author, and he had listened to our episode with Lou Vero talking about Tarasoff and all of the great. Lessons learned and how the ADM was built for the USA based on a lot of the things that Lou and company learned from around the world. But he actually has like expert knowledge on the 1972 Summit Series, which was a summit, which was a hockey series between Canada and Soviet Union. We're going back way back to 1972. Who was our president then? Was that Carter or Ford? Who was that?
I think that, no, Carter was closer to it. Oh, no, it might have been Ford or Nixon.
Ford or Nixon. I think it was Ford. But yeah, that's how far back we're going. So we're going back even before, I think, the Cold War, wasn't it? I think the Cold War had...
The Cold War was actually in the early 60s.
Early 60s going on. Okay, well, there's my history that I needed to learn. But he did... and developed a relationship with Vladislav Tretiak, and he was someone that Lou Vero talked about as well. And he gives a great, play by play of that called "When Canada Shut Down" was the name of the book, and then the other book that he wrote was called "The Goal That United Canada." And that had a foreword from Don Cherry, whom we all know in the hockey world from Hockey Night in Canada and everything that he's done for the game. But what's cool is Sean even has done a speech at the Hockey Hall of Fame. He moderated a speakers panel up in Toronto, if you haven't been there. Oh, my God, it's beautiful. Yeah, and he's been on over 35 media outlets talking about what he's done because he developed the skill of question-based mapping, which created over 1,000 mind maps that really helps people with strategic planning, speaking, writing, research, goal setting, that kind of thing. And he's going to walk us through how that 72 series and the how he developed this process of mind mapping. Based on the game of hockey.
Great. That's great, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you today?
Hey, doing well. We've got Lou on the phone.
Hey, Lou. Nice to meet you.
Okay, sounds great.
Well, we did your introduction, just telling a little bit about the books that you've written and the inspiration that you had from them and developing your process for mind mapping. But what I'd like to know is, where are you today, and do you have tickets to the Canes games?
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm heading to the game tonight for game one against New Jersey. And, I think it's a toss-up series. So I'm really excited to go with my son and share some great memories.
That's awesome. And that arena is a pretty great one to watch a game in.
It's like having a college atmosphere at an NHL game. So there's a lot of energy. It gets really loud and it's just a fun experience.
That's awesome. Well, good. This second round is a shocking second round, in my opinion. Everybody you thought was going to be going on pretty much isn't.
Yeah, it definitely makes it interesting, and there's probably going to be a new Stanley Cup winner, so that'll be
fun.
That'll definitely make some fan base really happy.
Yes, yes, it will, and it will grow the game in that city because that's what Stanley Cups tend to do, no matter what. Of course, I don't think you could grow it more in Toronto. Isn't that where you're from originally?
Yeah, I'm originally from Toronto, and you know they just had such a drought of winners. You know, it's been so long, so there's, you know, multiple generations that have never really experienced this before. And I was thinking, even them winning the first round, it was 2004, and I was thinking what was happening back then. I mean, that was a long time ago. So, you know, that was like the Stanley Cup for them. If they win the second round, it'll be crazy. So they're definitely hockey mad city.
Yeah. I think that, I don't know if Gary Bettman would be happy with it, but how cool would it be to have a Leafs Oilers Stanley Cup final?
Yeah, I don't think he'd be too happy.
I don't think he'd be happy.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's been so long since a Canadian team has won the cup. And, you know, one of the things is the NHL needs to keep marketing the best players. And Connor McDavid is the best player in the universe. And then Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. So I think there's a lot that can be done with that. I think it'd be a tremendous series. And, you know, if the Canes don't make it in, I hope that's the final, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that one too myself. Sorry to my Dallas fans, but I can't stand Dallas and I do not want them there. I know I have a lot of Dallas listeners and I love you ladies and gentlemen and I love all of our friends there. And I lived there for three times in my life, but I'm just not a fan of Dallas sports teams. I don't have a problem saying it.
Well, they're gonna have their hands full. So I don't know.
yeah, they are. Well, so Sean, give us some of your background before you started writing books. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Toronto. Did you play the game? You know, what are the things that led you to where you are?
Yeah, you know, I was probably like a lot of kids. I grew up playing sports, loved sports, and played hockey and baseball. So in Canada, or especially in the Toronto area, there's four distinct seasons. So, you know, it just made a lot of sense to play hockey in the winter. I grew up as a goaltender, so that was something I really enjoyed. And then in the summer, I'd play baseball, and then we had a very distinct season. So, you know, being in North Carolina, you know, you never see snow. But in Canada, you know, basically you have between May and September to get your games in, and then it's over. So I think, you know, I think one of the benefits of that, and Wayne Gretzky has said this before, is it's good to play multiple sports up until a certain point or a certain age, because you get different skill sets. You don't burn yourself out. And, you know, you learn a lot from different sports. And I think that's a great thing. And, you know, I think a lot of Canadians did that, playing multiple sports all the time.
Well, and I think they had the more of the ability to, because they could go out on a pond and play hockey whenever they wanted. And, you know, it's interesting, Sean, because I was literally just thinking about this yesterday. It's a big topic, obviously, playing two sports or three sports or whatever, exposure.
Yep.
So I did one sport. I was focused from literally age six, and this was my personal focus. All the way through, I graduated from high school, and it was all about gymnastics. And that was all I wanted to do. Didn't want to change. So I'm okay with single sport focus. However, I think when people talk about you should play two sports, they think team sports. What about jiu-jitsu? What about karate? What about, you know, running, or, you know, all of these different disciplines that can also teach you great things versus just a team sport? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I totally agree. It doesn't have to be just team sports. I think the more things that you can get into and the more, you know, skills and disciplines, I mean, it's all good for the body and the mind. So I agree with you. I mean, I think there's benefits to doing all of that.
And skiing. Oh, I did ski growing up. My coaches were always petrified whenever my family went skiing every January 2nd. They're like, no, don't get injured. But fortunately,
I had the same problem. You weren't allowed to ski in college because on scholarship,
right,
you got hurt. That was a no-no, man. That was a no-no.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. But it's the best thing. I love skiing so much.
But it's funny you bring up skiing, because I played competitive baseball. So I ended up, baseball was my sport in the end, and I played up to junior ranks in Canada. And during one of the off seasons, I did go skiing, and on a mogul run, I end up going over a mogul and jamming my shoulder into it. Oof. And my final year, I couldn't pitch very well because of my shoulder injury. I had cortisone shots, and so you never know how these things go. But I think seven of the guys that I played with, we had a really good team in a very small city. Seven of the guys ended up going to the States to play ball at different areas.
Oh, wow.
So it was always on my radar about the U.S., but and maybe there was a possibility to do that, but, you know, with the skiing thing, so it's just funny you bring up skiing as a possible injury.
Yeah, well, and I get it, because I was a fearless skier, because if you're a gymnast, you're pretty much a fearless athlete anyway, right?
Yes,
and, yep. And I was a fearless skier. My saying was always, I get down that mountain faster than anybody, but it's not pretty.
Well, and you like speed, and you probably have pretty good balance as a gymnast. So, yeah. You know, there's a lot of things going on there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's still something that you can do versus you're not going to see me up on a beam doing, you know, back handsprings and back tucks right now. So I can still ski, right. Though.
Yeah, yeah. So just, you know, go back to a little bit, the journey that I've had in getting to North Carolina, you know, even though the baseball career didn't go further, you know, I was always kind of interested in the U.S. And during the tech boom, I was recruited by Verizon to come down and work in Richmond, Virginia originally. So that brought me down here. And, you know, I noticed there was a lot of Canadians in the southern region, especially in North Carolina when I moved from Virginia to North Carolina. And I put together a Canadian group. And ironically, the first event that we had was a hockey game at a sports bar. And, you know, hockey is such a great connector for Canadians.
Yeah.
By the end of the first year, we had a Christmas party for over 120 people in the area.
Oh, wow.
So that kind of snowballed into, you know, having different speakers and people come down. And, you know, we'll be talking about the 72 series. And that was kind of the genesis of how I kind of got involved in that aspect.
Okay, so you were here at that time, or were you, and when you started, when the series happened, or?
Well, for the 72 series, what I mean by that is, you know, there was, that happened back in 1972.
Right.
You know, certainly, you know, a lot of Americans know the Miracle on Ice story with the Herb Brooks team against, you know, the vaunted Soviets.
Yep.
Well, 8 years earlier, there was this series called the Summit Series, and it was supposed to be a friendly 8 games, 4 games in Canada and 4 games in Moscow. And really, if you look back, people love the best on best series, right? When you have like the best Canadians or the best Americans playing against the best Swedes and Finns.
Yeah.
Really, that was the first time that it happened. And the interesting thing is the teams didn't really know each other, meaning that, you know, the Soviets had had tons of success in the international level, world championships and the Olympics. And they, you know, you had to be an amateur in that case, but really they weren't, because all they did was play hockey. They weren't, even though they were, you know, part of the military, they were hockey players.
Right.
And so, you know, they wanted to see how they would match up against the NHL stars. And in this case, you know, representing Canada. So that was kind of the 72 series. And what happened was, you know, most prognosticators thought it was going to be all 8 games for Team Canada. On that team, you had people like Phil Esposito, Brad Park, Ken Dryden, just a whole list of Hockey Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
Bobby Orr was on that team, but he was injured. And so they thought they'd win all 8 games. And the Soviets shocked them the first game in Montreal, winning 7-3. And in all Canada, you know, went into depression. You know, they couldn't believe this.
Right.
And the series went back and forth. Canada had to win the last 3 games in Moscow. Oof. And on the final game, which happened on a Thursday, this gentleman named Paul Henderson scored the game-winning goal with 34 seconds left. And basically all of Canada erupted. This was one of those moments in a country's history where they literally rolled TVs into classrooms from Victoria to Newfoundland.
I love it.
It was kind of like the man on the moon memory type of thing.
Yeah.
And so, I brought Paul to speak in North Carolina just before the 40th anniversary of his goal. And it was amazing because, you know, you talk to baby boomers and, you know, you're asking them to recall memories 40 years earlier. And I would say 80% of the people could tell you exactly where they were with emotion in their eyes. And that's pretty remarkable for anybody, like for that broad of an audience. And so, so Paul came down, we had a great time here, probably 100 people in the audience. And then he golfed, he loves golfing. And 3 months later, he was diagnosed with cancer. And so my concern was if, you know, if anything ever happened, a lot of these stories would kind of wouldn't be told or shared. And so I said, you know, if I collect stories for the 40th anniversary of your goal, you know, would you support me? And he said, yep. And so I collected over 220 stories, of which we picked the best 72 of them. And that is in the book called The Goal That United Canada.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So it's, you know, the very diverse stories. It's more about, you know, human interest, if you will. Stories, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that can remember when, you know, Mike Ruzzioni scored for the U.S. against the Soviets. Same thing in Canada, but there was, you know, stories about people being listening to transistor radios in coal mines, being on top of telephone poles, you know, working for the telephone company. People getting so excited they jump up and hit their head on a beam and knock themselves out. I mean, just a lot of funny things that were happening all across the country.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. It's amazing how those sports moments in history of countries, how they're just as important as some of the other, you know, political moments or social moments that may have happened. But man, there's nothing like that feeling, is there?
Right, right. And I was just,
on the other end, too.
Toronto.
Sorry.
I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago at a sports card expo, and we had a booth, you know, selling some of the books there, and the number of people who had still come up and wanted to talk about the series, the number of people who are hardcore collectors who like who would buy sticks that were used during the series. I mean, it's just incredible how, you know, so many years later, it's still so important.
Yeah.
And yeah. I saw, you know what, cause I'm a little older, but I remember some video I saw where when that series started, I mean, some of the Canadian players were warming up or practicing in their shorts. They thought it was just going to be just a holiday, right? It was like a big joke. Oh, we're going to play the Russians. But then it turned into something very serious, right?
Okay. That's exactly right. And it goes back to, you know, one thing is they didn't know them, but also just how hockey was so different back then. Like, just to put in context, a lot of the players had jobs in the off season. They didn't make a lot of money, so they didn't have the big, you know, million-dollar contracts. A lot of them would make, you know, they'd make a living and maybe, you know, worked at the farm or had a hockey camp or, you know, so they didn't, coming to training camp, it was trying to work off the 10 or 20 pounds they gained. They didn't really work out during the off season. That wasn't a thing back then. Uh-huh. And so when they came, they, you know, they, between, you know, practices and stuff, they'd have a few beers, you know, it was pretty lackadaisical. And
These guys smoked in the locker room in the early 70s.
Heck yeah.
That's right.
Late 60s. And I remember Phil Esposito, well, if you wrote the book, I remember Phil Esposito's plea to the Canadians on video. I saw it, right? And
yep.
I actually know Phil. So, like, when they were playing and when they were down, he was saying to the Canadian, the country, because they were booing them. They were down on them, right? Obviously, right?
That's right.
Says, like, these guys are really good. And we're out here really trying. It's not hocus pocus, like the Russians are terrific.
Yeah.
And we're out here giving it our all. And I think it was a national play, I think. You've probably seen the video, right? Of him like saying to them, like, we're doing the best we can. It's not a joke.
Yep.
I've actually talked to Phil about that a couple times and many years ago. So
Phil really was the leader and the catalyst of that team. And you know, the funny thing is, in talking to them afterwards, the players themselves didn't see the speech, but, you know, obviously it was broadcast all across Canada for Canadians. It kind of unified the Canadians to get behind the team. And what happened next was they head off to Moscow And what a lot of people don't know is that 3,000 Canadians traveled for the 10 days to watch those four games during the Cold War. So, you know, it was kind of unbelievable because, you know, you didn't have tourism in Moscow back in 1972 like that. So they all went over and they stayed in hotels and they partied with the players. And so in the books, we've interviewed about 12 people who were there for the 12 days. Wow. And in fact, one lady was kind enough to share her diary for the whole trip.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing. So,
yeah. So, you know, and funny things like behind the scenes, you know, they'd be partying with champagne. You know, there was all, you know, basically unlimited champagne and vodka, but, you know, they didn't like, you know, the mixed drinks because there was no Coke or ginger ale. So, you know, that's kind of how they partied and got together and just had a great time. But it was, they bonded as a community, and the players will say that to win the final three games in Moscow, those 3,000 Canadians were instrumental in giving them energy and helping them through those tough games.
Wow, that's unreal.
Fans can make a difference. The seventh man, that's for sure. It's a real thing.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, there was just so many stories. And, you know, the Soviets would play some psychological warfare. The Canadian team brought over some beer, milk, and steaks. and some of those things were lost or stolen, if you will, you know, to kind of tick the players off a little bit who wanted their beers and steaks after the game. So, you know, those were things we're kind of playing behind the scenes, which was kind of interesting.
That's like with Lou Vero, he shared with us during the 80 Olympics in Lake Placid that there was a group of Russians that were now either Americans or Canadians. I think they were Canadians, weren't they, Lou? And they came down to America and were actually yelling things at the Soviet team.
Can't remember it.
Yeah, okay. I think that they were Canadian, and they came down to Lake Placid because it's right there. And they were, like, hurling insults in Russian to the Soviet team, and they were super flustered. And,
I remember that. You're saying that now. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. And, you know, and hey, I mean, okay, we're talking to a bunch of hockey parents here on this podcast. When my son was like, I don't know, nine years old, maybe 10, we played against a team from Beijing. And these kids were doing, you know, Tai Chi and yoga and all of this, like, very strict movement, strict warm-up, everything, and they demolished everybody over here. And so before we played them the second time, I'm like, I'm going to go get them a bunch of McDonald's. I'm going to leave it in their locker room, and they will be much slower on the ice. So, hey, it's all tactics, right, for the win.
That's right. Yep. And one of the reasons why, you know, everybody thought the Soviets were going to be so bad was their equipment was so terrible. They did, you know, we're pretty fortunate with all the things that we have in North America, you know, all this nice skate shin pads and sticks. And again, back in 1972, you know, all their stuff was really flimsy. Their skates looked poor. Their sticks weren't great. In fact, one of the people that we interviewed for the book was somebody we call the Russian stick boy. And what happened was back in the early 70s, one of the things, if you noticed watching either the Miracle on Ice game or even the 72 series, the Russians didn't take a lot of slap shots. And I think part of the reason was because their sticks broke so easily. And the coach of the team, Tarasov, at that time said, he didn't want players like Karlamov or Yakushev to come off the ice if the stick broke. So he brought somebody in to basically stand at the bench. If the player broke their stick, he would hand them another stick. And that was, in some ways, the birth of the stick boy. So it was all based on, you know, poor equipment.
Wow. See, and then one of my favorite movies that even says in there, it's not the equipment, it's the skater. So so there you go. The Russians proved it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this guy who we interviewed for the book, he was a fascinating gentleman, and he was so he was really so helpful in telling stories. He had that position from basically 1970 to 1984. And he was a friend growing up of Tretiak. So he basically saw all these wonderful Soviet teams during the heyday of their time. And then later on, he would be the general manager of the World Junior team, you know, that would compete in the World Junior tournaments. And, you know, he had, you know, guys on his team like Ovechkin and Vasilevsky and, you know, Svechnikov, all these people who've had great NHL careers. And he was a part of those moments as a GM.
That's amazing. You know, when I was reading your bio, and, you know, I obviously know about the Russian Five and all of the influence of Russian hockey and everything. Do you know, I just read something yesterday, and we don't have to talk long about this, but I think it's an important topic. The war that Russia has waged on Ukraine, players are now being required to stay in Russia and not come to the United States, and they're being required to sign contracts with the KHL and play there. Have y'all read anything about that?
No, I haven't seen that. Huh.
It's to the point where I believe it's Tarasenko said he may not go back to Russia for the summer. Was it Tarasenko? I can't remember who it was.
Yeah,
for the Rangers.
About that.
Yeah, because he's afraid that he's going to have to play the KHL, but of course then that means he's going to have to, you know, denounce his, you know, Russian citizenship, I'm sure. But that's a pretty big political influence for where the NHL might be over the next several years if we're not able to have the cadre of players coming over and that influence.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. So there you go. There's a first thought on that. I think it's wrong. But there you go. I think they should be allowed to do whatever they want. But we live in America.
There's a lot of nuances with sports and politics, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's ruined it.
There's a book. I've been working with the Olympics for the past year and a half, and there is a book of the intersection of politics and the Olympics. I mean, it's the biggest stage in the world, so it's the biggest opportunity to share whatever you're trying to accomplish. I mean, 1972 being a year in Munich, Germany,
right?
With that exact situation. But let's go back to good things. Let's go back to the positive things of hockey. You mentioned Tretiak.
Yes.
So what was it about Tretiak and, you know, that 72 series and how, you know, obviously the 80 miracle game, and, you know, what did you learn, you know, about him and from him to propel you into what we'll talk about next?
Sure. He was probably one of the most fascinating individuals in the book. And in fact, in the second book that I did, when Canada shut down, that we probably could have had 8 or 10 stories about Tretiak. Everything from being drafted by the Montreal Canadiens in 1984 to basically having goalie schools throughout North America. So he was in Minnesota a lot, teaching U.S. goalies, which was fascinating. And, you know, really, he was no doubt a student of the game. And one of the things leading up to the 70s was the Soviets were wonderful skaters, great passers, but they struggled with finding good goalies. And one of my theories is, going back to the story I told you about the broken sticks, is, you know, you didn't have people like Bobby Hull or Phil Esposito or Bobby Orr taking hard shots on the goalies back then, because, again, the sticks were brittle. So they would always look for the perfect pass and the perfect backdoor play. You know, they weren't looking to take shots. So as a goalie, you're just not going to get the same work and practice of getting the repetitions of those hard shots. Now, he had incredible agility, but he had to do different things. So off the ice, he had people whale tennis balls at him, and he would try to make saves to get his hand-eye coordination as quick as possible. I also read a story about leading up to the 72 series, that the Soviets made a puck shooting machine.
Oh, really?
So that it wouldn't break sticks, and to give him repetitions. So, you know, very innovative. Yeah. He also had, you know, what was interesting about him, his parents, his mom was a phys ed teacher who had basically trained a lot of the great Soviet athletes. And his dad was just, you know, a hard driving father who said, you know, you've got to be the best that you can be. He was always, you know, he was tough on him. And so having those two influences in his life really shaped him. To want to be educated, and how to do these things. And two, keep striving to be the best, because his goal was to play for the national team. That was always his goal.
That's always a great goal. That's really good. Well, and so I love hearing about innovations in hockey, and I'm trying to think, when was that first face mask for goalies? Was there already a face mask at this point? I think there was.
Yeah, I mean, the first face mask was Jacques Plante. In fact, that's a great story in itself. One of the things that he did was he wanted to model NHL goalies, because they were the best at that time, and Jacques Plante was the goalie back then. And so in some of the times when they were able to come to Canada on tours, just like not the national team, but other teams, he was able to actually meet Jacques Plante. And there was one time when his coach at that time was Tarasov. Tretiak was showering after a practice, and the Montreal Canadiens were there. And Tarasov pulled Tretiak out of the shower and says, "You can't be in here getting clean. You need to go see Plante and see what he's doing and study him."
Oh.
And so he hustled out of the shower, got to the Montreal Canadiens were practicing with Plante, and he would stand behind the net and watch Plante and kind of take mental notes of all the things that he was doing to be a better goalie.
Wow.
So Plante had a big influence on him, and the Canadian goalies at that time, a lot of them would come out to challenge the shooters, and the Russian goalies at that time, they would stay in the net. So they weren't cutting down the angle. So they learned, some of that trait from the NHL goalies, and also to use their stick more and trying to keep the pucks behind the net. So there was a lot of things that they were studying all the time, and they would even try to get films of NHL goalies or teams that they didn't have in the Soviet Union. They were always looking for more information.
Huh. Wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either. And but again, see, it goes back to when you're developing anything, you look to the best, but then mold it into what is best for you personally, or your culture, or your team, or whatever the place you are trying to put that lesson into motion with. So I love that.
The crazy thing is, I mean, we have so much information today.
Yeah.
I was talking to Don Waddell, who's the president of the Hurricanes, and, he can basically get all the videotape he wants from the KHL or the MHL in Russia to see how his players that he's drafted are doing and look at it the next day. And, again, back then we had nothing.
Right.
Another funny story about Tretiak was, the deal that the Soviets made with the NHL at that time was they would get an opportunity to scout the NHL players before the series, and vice versa. There'd be a couple of scouts go to Moscow to watch them play. And what happened was, and this was probably about a few weeks before the series started, Tretiak was playing in a game, and two Toronto Maple Leaf scouts were there. And what happened was he went on to give up 8 goals. And so they looked at him and said, we're not going to have any problems. This guy is almost like a junior B goalie. So there was a false sense of security. What they didn't know at the time was the next day Tretiak was getting married. And so his mind wasn't really on that game. It was probably one of the few times that he ever gave up 8 goals. And so there's a story about that in the book, but it's kind of funny that I kind of say, in some ways, the Soviets kind of sandbagged, the NHL scouts not being up front, that this was a major moment in his life. And so they went on to think that he was just a poor goalie, and he was actually one of the stars in the first 4 games.
Oh. Yeah, maybe he was intoxicated, too.
I'm sorry?
He might have been intoxicated. And he was getting mad.
Now, whether there was a bachelor party that night, I can't. I've got mixed messages on that, but
no one's
I'll
really
let people
coming clean.
Think
huh?
what they think.
Yeah. And
but
wait,
it was funny because leading up to the 50th anniversary of the series, and we interviewed Tretiak and the Russian stick boy, and we were able to convey happy 50th anniversary of your wedding as well as the series. So It just happened literally weeks before the series started.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is amazing. Oh, wow. And is he still, where is he living now?
He's still in Moscow. And, you know, he's just such an amazing individual. I mentioned he's a student of the game, and he's really carried that through his life. He is the head of Russian Hockey Federation.
Oh.
And so he's really been a big influence. And even, you know, one of the stories in the book is about when he first took over in 2006, one of the challenges, if you look back in the NHL at that period of time, there were basically no Russian goalies who were effective. And there was a reason for that. The reason was in the KHL, which is kind of the, you know, the Russian pro league, most of the goalies who were playing for the pro teams were from Sweden and Finland and other countries. Mm-hmm. So what was happening is they weren't developing their own goalies. They weren't getting the reps to play against the best players in Russia. And in 2006, Tretiak made a policy, basically said, the Russian pro teams, if you put in somebody from another country, you're going to have to pay a penalty. You're going to have to pay real money, a tax, if you will. And so all of a sudden, they started putting in Russian goalies. And then if you look today, you know, first of all, there were, you know, back in the day, there was, you know, Bobrovsky, Happy Boulin, you know, a number of those guys. And today there's probably 8 or 10 starting goalies who are some of the best goalies in the NHL. And I would say Tretiak has a huge influence of what's happening today.
That's, yeah, because, I mean, look at the proliferation of Russian goalies. I mean, it has been. It used to be the Finns, which they still are.
Yep.
But the Russian goalies over the last, I don't know, 8-10 years, would you say?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, really proliferated. And a good friend of mine is a Russian goalie, Ilya Bryzgalov, and my son plays against his son. And he's going to come on the show, but he... I love what he talks about from growing up in Russia, playing goalie and the lessons he learned and everything like that. So it'll be interesting when I talk to him to bring some of these ideas into the conversation and hear his response. He's a character. Oh my gosh. I love him.
Yeah. love him. For sure. And then the other side of Tretiak was he also impacted, you know, the NHL goalies or the Canadian goalies and specifically, Chicago Blackhawks brought him in to be a goalie coach. And at that time, Chicago had two goalies, Ed Balfour and Dominic Hasek.
Well, there and, you go.
I mean, two Hall of Fame goalies, right?
Yeah, yep.
And Tretiak, so for the book, I interviewed Ed Balfour about his relationship with Tretiak. And he said, you know, Tretiak's my brother. You know, that's how close they are. And how he feels about him. When Balfour got inducted to the Hockey Hall of Fame, the first person he thanked was Tretiak.
Oh, wow. Thanks. That's amazing. So
a lot of people don't see the connection of how, you know, he's helped coach and influence a lot of young goalies, including female goalies. You know, I've talked to people who went to those goalie schools and just his focus and determination and, you know, they saw that, you know, he was really focused on playing for keeps, and he wanted to instill that in the young people. And then he took that on to the NHL with the Blackhawks. So, you know, it's just before he went back and became the head of the Russian Hockey Federation. So he really is an ambassador of the game. There's nobody that I've seen talked to that had a bad word about Tretiak. And, you know, his impact on hockey is just incredible. He's almost the Wayne Gretzky side from, you know, Russian hockey goalies.
Well, and I love hearing the ambassador of the game. Do you think, you know, talk a bit about how, you know, his thought process around what it takes to be a student of the game, of becoming a better goaltender. Is it all between the pipes on the ice, or what else is it that makes a goalie a good goalie?
Yeah, that's a great question. The funny thing is, you know, for the second book, we could only do 72 stories, but there was one story that I researched around that topic that actually didn't make the book just because we had so much about Tretiak. And that was that I found out in the early 70s, not only did he get his undergrad in physical education, but he went on to get his master's. And one of the things that he did for his master's was to do a thesis paper on goaltending. And, you know, if you think about people we know or even ourselves, how many people would do a thesis paper on their career? And I don't know of anybody who's done that. But he's probably spent, 6 months or so, probably did around 30 or 40 pages on goaltending. And what I found was that he really looked at his position very holistically. And what I mean by that is it wasn't just about the things that happened on the ice, like, goaltending technique. He talked about modeling others. We talked about the Jacques Plante story, talked about the relationship with his players, how he basically orchestrated his defense. Uh-huh. So he was very aware of how he did that. The relationship with the coach to bring the best out of him. Remember back then, like, there wasn't any goaltending coaches. It was just the coach. He would talk about his off-ice preparation, of what he would do to become innovative in getting his hand-eye coordination. Talked about the tennis balls. He would do a lot of different tumbling. He had a lot of different things that he would do in those aspects. He also talked about the mental side of things. Obviously, as a goalie, you're the last line of defense. If you let in big goals, you got to be able to handle the emotional aspect of that. He discussed that as well. He also talked about routines. So setting routines for himself that would give him confidence and repetition. And, we're having skills coaches. We have sports psychologists now. These are kind of evolutions, I think, of the things that Tretiak was doing 50 years ago. And probably one of the reasons why he was the first goalie to be in, or the first player to be inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame that had never played in the NHL. I mean, that's how the hockey world thought about him.
Wow.
Jeez. Yeah. That's
so amazing. He was really impressive.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, goodness. Well, and if you did do a thesis on your profession back then, it may have led you away from your profession, but instead it made him even better and stronger and having that education underneath. So, what was his thesis on? In goaltending, what was his subject within goaltending?
It was, basically how to be the best goalie that you could be. And he broke it also down to other things like character traits. So what type of character would you have to have as a goalie? What type of personality? So he was very aware of that. Like if you're a goalie and you had a temper, that probably wasn't going to go very well.
Is that Jordan Binnington then? Do we need to have him read the thesis?
that might have been the chapter back then, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So he, talked about very, talked about his equipment, talking about, what types of things he would study other players. So he looked at somebody who was right-handed or left-handed or what they did before. I mean, he was like, when I say student of the game, he really was. He was analyzing everything. And I think the first part is awareness. But then the second part is understanding your strengths and also your weaknesses. And he really did that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And when you say that, we compare it to Jordan Binnington. And obviously, yep. Jordan's anger did not bode well for him this season, but how has it changed in the modern world from when he wrote his thesis to today? What do you see as some modernizations that have happened?
Yeah, one final point I'll add about that is reflection. One of the things that he said after he did his paper was that in looking back, there were some things that he had in his paper that he was maybe naive about or that he was wrong about. So I think that's the other thing about us, as we try to become student of the games, we also have to look back and say, what did I get right about my planning and strategies? What did I get wrong? And I think, going back to your question, each of the positions have gotten so detailed. I mentioned sports psychology. I mean, there's a lot of players who now do mental training and visualization. Back in the 70s, the 80s, and even part of the 90s, like those things didn't happen.
Unless people you're weren't a doing... gymnast, I was doing that at that time. But
right,
but you do that.
And who was your influence then? Was it like Mary Lou Retton or people or people before then?
No, I competed with her as people before then. So it was Nadia Comaneci was the biggest influence on me. And Kathy Rigby, of course, here in the United States. But it was more, you know, and I don't remember if it was my coach who talked about visualization, but I remember practicing my routines at night in my head and then right before going on. And I tell you what, Sean, I still do that today. I do curling, and before every throw, I visualize the throw I'm going to do. If I've got a big presentation in front of a big audience for work, I visualize what I'm doing there. I think visualization is one of the strongest tools, strongest mental tools we can use.
I totally agree. And you don't, you know, you can do as many reps in your head as you want, right?
Yeah.
And you can always win.
You can always win, and you don't get hurt.
that's right. So yeah, I totally agree. I think that's an undervalued opportunity, not just for people's sports, but like you said, like for anything that they do in life. And I do that, you know, when I do speaking engagements or media interviews or I use visualization as well. I did that as a goalie.
Yeah, that's great. And so how did all of this lead you to question-based mapping?
Yeah, that's a good question. And going back to our visual natures, what I find is, you know, a lot of people, and I'll use a ballpark number, you know, 70% plus are visual people in terms of their learning styles. And so, you know, when I came to the U.S., I was in technology sales, and I'd be preparing for meetings. And, you know, we grew up in a linear environment, right? We have, you know, pen, paper, or, you know, thinking about organizing information top to bottom. And what I found was it wasn't really working for me. I needed something that was a little bit more nonlinear, that I could see a core idea and then see how ideas branched off from that. And then I could see the relationships and associations. And so 20 years ago, I started what's called mind mapping. And, you know, in the past 20 years, I've done about over 1,000 mind maps for a lot of different applications, whether it's writing my book or doing interviews or, you know, goal setting, a number of different applications. And so I've refined that process. Now I do what's called, what I refer to it as question-based mapping, because, you know, if we ask more effective questions, you know, typically we get better outcomes. And by seeing information organized more broadly or from the core idea, our brains become more creative because some of the questions trigger things that we wouldn't have thought of otherwise. And so I teach people in a number of different areas, whether it's in business or sports or, you know, even helping people do book outlines through the process of question-based mapping.
That's fascinating. So I have a little trick on how I recognize if someone's a visual, auditory, or kinesthetic learner. And tell me if you ever heard this. And I do this before meetings or whatever, because then it gives you an ability to communicate with the person the way that they can understand you better. And I learned this, I don't even know, a long time ago. But if you ask somebody to tell you a story from when they were 10 years old, and the person will think, you know, and that's your first cue. Do they look up? Do they look to the side? Do their eyes? Do their eyes go up?
Yes.
Do their eyes go side? Their eyes go down? Have you heard of this?
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay, Lou. So if you're talking, you say, you just ask the person to tell you a story. You don't care about the story as the listener. You only care about being able to see which direction they go. If they go up, they're a visual listener or learner, and if they go to the side, they're auditory, and if they go look with their eyes go down, they're a kinesthetic. So you can change how you communicate with them. So you, Sean, as a visual learner, I would say, I see where you're going with that. That looks like a really great idea. Whereas me, I'm an auditory learner. Someone would say, I hear you. I hear what you're saying there. And so you would do things so that that person can understand what you're saying better. So it's a little trick to use.
Yeah, I love it. It's a great idea, and it's a great way to be more effective communicator. I'm sure that works well for you.
Yeah, well, it's harder. It's harder today, though, in the Zoom world, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
It's harder. So, talk about your the workshops that you do around question-based mapping and how it would benefit both young athletes, parents, corporate athletes, if you will?
Yeah, going back to, you know, just the student of the game mindset. And by the way, this is, you know, we're talking about applying to sports, but really this could be applied to anything. It could be applied to education. It could be applied to people getting their first job or jobs. It could be applied to rolling out their careers. And so going back to athletes, whether it be hockey or other, what I would do is probably take some of the ideas that I shared with you about from Tretiak's thesis. And so, you know, the first thing is to get the ideas out there and break out. And we would do a workshop that would look to everything from, you know, goal setting, you know, what does somebody want to accomplish? The motivational aspect of why, you know, why is an important factor in all this? Because if somebody's not that motivated, they're not going to do the work. Right. You know, also talk about commitment and sacrifice. One of the things I didn't share that, you know, when Tretiak said he wanted to be a goaltender for the national team, his coach said, this year, you're probably going to have to do about 1,300 hours to be the goalie of the national team. Are you prepared to do that? Mm. And Tretiak said, yes.
Well, of course, that was his goal. Yep.
Mm. That was his goal. But, you know, some people want to have really big goals, but they're not committed to doing the time and the effort. and so if that's not there, there's a gap, right?
So I want to just, on that point, I just want to say, so I don't know if you ever heard of, well, when I say this, people say, sure, I heard of it, but have you ever heard of the expression ham and eggs? I guess we all have, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it goes far beyond that. And I think I shared this with Julie. Fred Shiro, the old coach of the Flyers, who's gone now, yep, for his son, Ray. And his father had a saying in the locker room, ham and eggs. And the boys and the Flyers early won two cups, obviously. They'd say, ham and eggs, boys, ham and eggs. And there's a reason why they use that phrase. And I don't know if you ever heard it, but ham and eggs comes from two things, commitment and when someone's committed or when someone's dedicated. Yep. And a chicken, the hen lays an egg every day, right? That's dedication. The pig, on the other hand, well, we all know what happens to him. That's commitment. Yep.
That's commitment. Yep. Yes.
That's commitment. So there's a big difference, right? Obviously. Yep. They're actually a world of difference, right? Correct? So I tell people that story and kids that story, and they go, first they go, ah, and then they go, oh my God. Well, that's the difference. You can be dedicated, but commitment is a different avenue, right?
Right, right.
So
it would have been cool if they had t-shirts made up back in the day, right?
Yeah, maybe somebody should do that.
There you go. We'll get some merch going there, Lou. You know,
exactly.
That's awesome. Flyers about that, yes.
Lou, when someone says he's a ham and egger player, I always thought it meant they were
they are. Yeah, that's just a mucker, ham and egger. Yeah, that's just a different, whole different avenue of what I'm talking about. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, all right, so we've got the two different ones. Because to me, a ham and egger is like your grinder,
For sure. Well, you don't share that. Remember, on the show with Lou Vero, he shared that.
Yeah.
That came from him.
Yeah.
Because he was friends with Fred. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. That's where that saying came from. Lou brought that up on the podcast.
Yeah, he did. Sean, where can people find your books, When Canada Shut Down and The Goal That United Canada?
We publish through lulu.com, lulu.com. And again, it's, The Goal That United Canada and When Canada Shut Down. And my last name is spelled MITTON.
Not like the mitten here in Michigan.
No. Okay. No, but I actually do have a coffee mug from Michigan that my brother-in-law gave me.
Oh, that's funny.
Yes.
We're in the mitten here. Well, and so what about your workshops? Are those something that you offer out to teams or so that they can do some of this mind mapping so that they can benefit from it?
Yeah, what I would do is, they're welcome to reach out to me. I can give my leave you with my email address.
Yep.
Which is canex, canex1@gmail.com. And What we would do is just basically, you know, I like to identify the age ranges first and the skill level. And then we would kind of do an introduction to question-based mapping and then dive right in, say, how can we apply this in your sport or field of endeavor? So in hockey, we would dive into all, some of those categories that we mentioned, and the players would have an opportunity to get their ideas out. We'd even get into things like, you know, what type of practice drills on and off the ice, you know, resource wise, who can you leverage to get better? It's always good to have coaches, but what about mentors and other people who can help make you more effective? Talk about things like sports psychology. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to be more effective. And I think really what I want to do is to say to people, if you want to be the best at what you're going to do, and it's a competitive environment, you got to think about it. You got to plan it and then execute. And if you do that, you're going to have a pretty good life.
Yeah. Sounds good. Good plan.
Yeah. I like that. And considering your background in baseball, and this is really universal. So parents, if you've got kids in other sports, this can benefit other athletes. This can benefit adults. This can benefit your team at work, all of those kinds of things.
And I wish I would have had this in school because, you know, going back to your discussion about learning styles, you know, I wasn't a great student back then. I couldn't, you know, my English teacher would have laughed that I wrote two hockey books. I mean, I was a C student in English, but, you know, I would have been able to been a much more effective student. It would have been less stressful and I would have been, you know, much more effective, but, you know, now I can teach others and hopefully they can have a better journey.
Yeah. Well, the things we learn when we're young compared to what we know when we're older, it's a vast chasm.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I sure appreciate you spending time telling us about all of this information around Tretiak and what he brought to the game, as well as the importance of that 72 series. I mean, really cool stories. I appreciate that a lot. And I'm going to get the book myself because it sounds fascinating.
Do you mind if I share one more story?
Absolutely.
So one of the things that we wanted to do with 50th anniversary book when Canada shut down is we wanted to pass these stories down to the younger generations because, you know, it was a much different time, but it was just an incredible series. And one of the things that we wanted to do in the book was we wanted to interview Tretiak's grandson and Paul Henderson's grandson, the two heroes of the series, right? Because we wanted to find out, you know, 50 years later, you know, what do they know about the series? What do they think about their grandparents being heroes and hockey legends? And so, so I asked Paul Henderson and he said, yeah, I'll set you up with my grandson. Not only did we have a great interview with him, but he became kind of almost like a consultant in the book because I wanted to make sure the stories resonated with him. And he's now a 20-year-old player playing hockey in Kinesis, Buffalo. Then we reached the other side, and through Tretiak and the Russian Stick Boy, they were, you know, they got us in touch with Max Tretiak, who's a goalie in the KHL. And in fact, his goalie partner three or four years ago was Elias Sorokin, the Islanders goalie.
Yeah.
So then, you know, once we'd interviewed them, we actually got them to meet together on Zoom and be able to talk to each other. And they basically asked each other questions about their hockey experiences.
Wow.
And that was so much fun. Wow. Just connecting them. And it happened where, you know, Max took the call or the Zoom call in his car because he had a 6-month-old daughter who was having her nap. So, you know, at the end of the day, they're just like us. They're trying to do the best they can, and they love hockey. And that was kind of some of my takeaways, but it was a special conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you've got, and there's other stories about the goal that saved a marriage and Sidney Crosby and his golden goal and where it was. So yeah, there's a lot of good stories in these books. So Lulu.com is the name, right?
Yep, that's where they can find the books, yep.
And it's The Goal That United Canada and When Canada Shut Down.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, Sean, this has been great. Thank you so much for participating and sharing all of this with our listeners.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and I've had a great time with both of you.
Okay, sounds great. Nice meeting you.